The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile. Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, where we believe that everyone is creative, but smart, creative people don't go it alone.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a SparkFile? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we actually do have answers.
We do. A SparkFile is the place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations. And if you're like us and you're making stuff all the time, you know that sometimes the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry. We're here to refill it.
We are on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a cabaret inspired by the true story of a theater troupe composed of unwitting and unwilling family members.
Or a one-man show that totally bros out, exploring masculinity, intimacy, and brotherhood.
Or interpretive work creating engaging characters in popular culture who are not singularly defined by a disability.
Or autobiographical work about a gay man with a high sex drive and cerebral palsy that questions our own ideas of inclusivity.
On today's Makersode, we're going to talk to someone who truly sparks us.
And that someone, wait for it, is Ryan Haddad. Ryan, welcome to
the SparkFile.
Ryan. Hi, Ryan.
I wish you could see the absolute giddiest smile.
Oh, good. I thought you fell asleep. I thought you were like, Jesus, ladies, come on.
What an intro.
No, I am stunned to hear my work so beautifully capsulized.
Oh.
And it was unexpected. I didn't expect them suddenly to be like, oh my God.
That's what we call the SparkFile treatment, baby.
I was like, they're talking about me without reading my bio. What a treat. Like, you actually.
It's so funny. In that little pause before you started to speak, this whole thing flashed through my mind. Remember when the opening credit, the title sequences of television shows were like 3 minutes long? And it was like, geez, Louise. And they had super long theme songs. I give you things like Paper Dolls, shows like that. I thought that you were over there just sort of like quietly, like, I don't know why I went dark, but that you were like, oh God, ladies, wrap it up. But I'm glad you had a positive response.
I had a really, really positive response. Now, you might have to trim what you just did because I was having headphones issues and I was zhuzhing. Just letting you know. Okay. I had a very positive response.
We can get all in.
So happy.
I was like, I can't believe. And then I was like, there are some things in here that they definitely have not seen. And they're still getting it right. I was like, beside myself for you. Because I was like, only 100 people saw that one show that you're talking about for one night, one time. And I was like, they're winning. I'm so glad the intro went well.
I hope we can keep it up for the rest of this interview.
Well. I think we're done. I mean, I think this is a great
It's a wrap. Good night, everybody.
We've learned what we can learn. I can't wait to actually ask you about that show because I'm so bummed I missed it. We've got questions galore about it.
Okay.
But Ryan, we're putting the little cart in front of the little horse. The little podcast cart
my
is in front of the
carriage.
Tiny podcast horse.
My carriage take me the ball.
That's right. We want to start by asking, where are you right now? Full street address, please. JK. And how are you right now for reals?
Wow. I'm in my new-ish studio apartment that I am renting in Hell's Kitchen. It is It is the first time I have lived alone in New York City.
That's so thrilling.
Aside from being in a dorm room in my senior year of college at the 92nd Street Y, but I don't count that.
But I think of it as like a rite of passage to live alone in New York City and be like, hey, this is my place. This is mine.
And I fully am only able to do that because of the plummeting rent prices as a result of the pandemic. Yeah.
Silver linings, baby. Silver linings.
You know, and like the most fun and also cumbersome and also horrifying like component of all this is I was in a sublet for 5 years. So, and then I was in a college dorm room and then I was in my parents' house. So I never have had to like make choices about furniture and decor ever.
Do you feel like it's a have to or get to? Like, are you excited to do it?
Good question.
Well, I am now that like it's mostly together or like some furniture has not arrived, but I know what it's going to be and it's like taped out on the floor where it's going to be. I feel a sense of relief and I feel like it's a privilege that I was given a chance to do this. But I know we're going to talk about it. I have a show streaming now until the end of February. But when I was in Washington, D.C. filming that show I was there for 3.5 weeks. Mm-hmm. I was getting ready because I was going to go straight from D.C. back to New York for the first time since COVID began. I had been with my family in Ohio. So what I knew I needed a bed for when I arrived and I needed a table to eat on.
Yep.
But I was trying to like make bigger decisions and have it all come together by the time I arrived in 3.5 weeks. And that was never going to happen.
That's really tricky.
I was never going to find a Wayfair or All Modern or West Elm or Article.
Name them CB2. All. Article, mm-hmm. Yes. Keep going. Yes.
Article and West Elm. Article and West Elm. I'm very, very happy so far. My bed is from Macy's. I'm very happy. I've got to say a couple of products.
Are you an affiliate? Are there going to be links underneath this podcast? Jeez,
no. No. But I will say that there were some... There were a couple of purchases that were, not as expensive. Did that even that were, that I chose, like, I'm not going to spend as much on this, so I'm not going to buy it from a more, moderately priced store. I'm going to go for Wayfair or All Modern instead. Wayfair, All Modern is an affiliate of Wayfair. And I just have to be honest and say that the two of those three items, like the wear and tear has already started in ways that it's like, I'm not like taking a hammer to this piece of furniture. So like why in three months and has this happened? Like, why does that happen? But I made some choices and I spent more money in some places than on others. And I'm learning what the consequences of that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is also a rite of passage. Welcome.
Yes.
Welcome.
To being like, why is that scratch here? Where did it come from? Why did I do
but
this?
This is the truth too. You can buy a really expensive and sometimes very well-made piece of furniture that doesn't wear well. There's that
it's
reality
true.
Too.
You can
so,
do that too.
So, you live, you learn.
Yes. Well, what I will say, the have to instead of get to part was when I was like trying to choose dining chairs aesthetically. And I spent 72 hours. I was supposed to be rehearsing a show and doing a show. And all I could think about for 72 hours.
Dining room chairs.
Yes.
Was my dining chairs. And I don't have a dining room. I have a dining corner with like a
nook.
A nook. But I was like, these chairs are my identity. Like, I can't get them wrong.
I lived in a studio for decades. And the truth of the matter is, in a space that small, I feel like decisions like that are even more important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep, yeah.
Because
we're going to need photos of those chairs, Ryan.
Oh my gosh. Well, I will say the dining chairs and the desk chair, all article. And I love article. I'm loving article. And
look at you just going for it with the sponsorship.
Aside from furniture sponsorships, which I don't possess. I love being in this new space. I'm very comfortable here. I am not sponsored by any furniture companies. but I've been able to make myself a home with even just like my family photos, you know, I made a big wall collage through something called, and this is not a sponsorship either, but it's called MPIX. M-P-I-X. No, but it's the most.
Use
so
the code HADAD for a 10% discount at checkout.
It is. This wall collage cost as much as a piece of furniture, okay?
But it is bigger
than my television. But it's next to my television, so you can see that it is bigger than my television. It is.
I love that.
It's a real rock for me because I have my family staring back at me while I eat dinner. I put it over the dining nook because that's one of the hardest parts. Some people are like, you must be happy living alone and living with yourself before you can ever have a relationship. And I am, and I am not nearly as lonely, even during COVID, as I thought I was going to be living by myself. But I think that eating alone is one of the hardest parts. Mm. And so I intentionally wanted their faces staring back at me while I was eating. And then I listen to podcasts or watch TV so that I don't feel like I'm just staring at this piece of chicken and it's going to be gone in 7 minutes. And now I have to wash every dish and clean the kitchen all the time.
But I wonder if you'll listen to this podcast while you eat your chicken next time. And you'll be like, I'm with myself and Laura and Susan. That's going to be weird and wonderful.
Ryan, I want to ask you a question. We always start with the Spark Vial price of admission. Just, really quick, can you tell us a creative risk that you've taken recently?
I'm going to say two.
Okay.
One is is a in-process thing that I'm working on right now from my home, which is I'm developing another solo play, a new solo play, new-ish solo play that I've been developing for several years with the wonderful director Jordan Fine. And it is currently called Dark Disabled Stories. But it's very possible that by the time we have this podcast drop, it's going to, even a week from now or 2 weeks from now, it's going to be a different title. We'll see. It's a solo play, but it's not a solo play anymore.
Mm.
And what we're doing that is not a risk, but a reward, I know that it's a reward, is working to make this particular play in progress, dates to be determined, a theater to be determined. It's commissioned by the Bushwick Star, and hopefully we're going to get another co-producer off-Broadway to commit to producing it post-pandemic, but that remains, uncertain. So right now it's, us and the Bushwick Star on Zoom doing the best we can.
Amazing.
To keep developing. And the thing that is the reward is we've decided that for this particular show of mine, we're going to make it as universally accessible as possible. You can never say that we are going to make it universally accessible because there's never going to be something that hits all access points at the same time. It just can't. But we're doing the best we can. So it is not a solo play anymore because there will be an audio describer on stage describing images and video and my performance visually for blind and low vision audience members. There will be a sign language performer, an ASL performer, to translate my performance from spoken text into sign language. So we will have at least two other humans on stage who are not me translating my performance into more accessible forms. Probably three other humans, but for now it's two. So that's three or four people in what once was a solo play about the disabled experience or the deaf and disabled experience, because we're going to have somebody interpreting ASL, we need to make forays into other identities. So mm-hmm. the risk is that in trying to make this accessible to everyone, I'm taking stories that were very centered on me alone and exploding them and trying to make space and give voice to other perspectives and other forms and kinds of disability within what was once a strictly personal narrative piece that still is probably a 70% or 75% personal narrative piece. But I recognize that I cannot just have those bodies on stage, humans on stage, like human lived experience on stage, and only center myself. So I must carve out room to give their stories voice and to give those perspectives inside of what is supposed to operate like a solo show mm-hmm. or solo play. And so I don't know yet, like, we're on the path to get there. Mm-hmm. We probably won't know until we are in front of an audience of mixed abilities or mixed forms of hearing if we are getting it right or not. And that we know is years away because of the limitations of the pandemic.
Right.
But I'm excited to take something that was going to be a little different, a little darker than my other solo plays, and now just be like, I'm sorry, everyone who was trying to raise money to fund this, but it isn't a solo play anymore. And we have to have four performers on stage, myself included. And that's going to take you even more fundraising, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's very important because we've decided, Jordan and I have decided, that this is not only part of the design and the construction, but also the engine and the purpose to
yes.
say, we are making a piece of disability theater. And we are doing everything we can, not only for blind and low vision people or deaf and hard of hearing people. We're going to attempt to make a relaxed performance. I don't know as much about that yet, so I'm not 100% sure that we're going to achieve that all the time at every performance. But we're certainly going to try our damnedest, right,
mm-hmm.
to make every performance or nearly every performance for the entire run as accessible and as inclusive as possible. Instead of, we're doing two sign language interpreted performances and two
right.
audio described performances and one relaxed performance. And that's not to, and also the creative risk is that I have work that has existed long before this play has existed that will continue to be performed, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be making work after this that isn't exclusively a piece of disability art, and
mm-hmm.
I'm making different stories and telling different stories. So I'm a little nervous because am I setting a precedent that every single time I do anything that it's going to have this kind of radical access for every story at all times? I can't make that promise that that's going to happen, and I don't know that it will serve every single piece of art to do this kind of very prominent inclusion every
right.
single time. And I might mm-hmm. be criticized for that. And I might have people say, well, you can't do it once and then not do it for everything else. I just need to release myself of that pressure and
That's
say
right.
that for this project, I am making a commitment
yep.
and it is informing every element of the script. It is informing every particle of storytelling that is going on in the show, and I can't zoom out and be scared of what the implications are going to be for the rest of my career.
That's right.
Because at the end of the day, I am an artist. you know, people say I'm a disabled artist, I'm a gay artist, I'm a Lebanese American artist, but I'm an artist and I can't predict what the future is going to bring, but I've made an intentional choice with the director who's developing the project and with the collaborators that we've brought on so far to help see this vision through, that this is what this play will be. And yeah. So we know there are positives and we know there are risks. And I know that there are risks to me as an entertainer. And because I'm making a kind of an activist statement by saying this is the play I'm putting out for the world. And, you know, I don't want it to stop me from making other kinds of art in the future.
Sure, of course, of course.
But I'm excited by it.
Hell of a, I'm excited by it too. Yeah. And I think it's safe to say you have been officially admitted into the Spark File. 100%. And you already started answering the next question, which is when people, maybe people who don't know you, meet you and say, well, what do you do? How do you identify creatively? How do you answer that? What do you do, Ryan?
I'm an actor, playwright, and autobiographical performer, which I know is the first line of my bio, so I'm so sorry.
That works. Boring. That works.
What I do as a creator, and not necessarily as an interpreter, but as a creator, is take creative nonfiction and put it on stage. And the way that that has manifested so far, most of the time, is autobiography, personal narrative, my experience, putting that on the stage.
Yeah.
But hopefully someday on the screen.
I like that.
We'll see. My manager is obsessed with me writing a pilot, and I keep saying next month, and then I don't do it.
You know, Ryan, this leads directly into something we wanted to ask you about, because we talk a lot about doing our own work, you know, on the Spark File. We really encourage people to tell their own stories and emphasize the importance of, like, not waiting for the phone to ring, as they say. Yeah. And when we look at your career thus far, and you have so much more to do, one of the things that makes us so excited about you is that you have really grabbed the bull by the horns and literally made a ton of work for yourself. And we're so curious to know, like, how and when you determined that that was one route you were going to take. I know it's not the only route, and we'll talk about the other work you do too, but you made a decision, obviously, to take this route. Did you have any doubts or reservations about it? What propelled you to do it? We want to know all about your take on that.
Oh, sure. Of course I had doubts and reservations. I was a sophomore in college and I was writing short plays in the playwriting class, and I was writing personal essays in the English department where I was in the creative writing concentration. And then I got wind that a fabulous gay solo performer and storyteller, Tim Miller, who is based in Los Angeles and has been, but what was a huge part of the downtown New York performance scene in the 80s and 90s before he moved to LA. A giant force, and founded institutions and buildings on both coasts. And he's extraordinary. And he's one of the NEA4, which was a cohort of individuals who received grant funding from the National Endowment for the Arts, and then had it taken away because the work was deemed
indecent
or too sexual or too profane or too, yes. And so they were censored by this giant arts quadrant of the government, right? Yeah. And they went to the Supreme Court with that. And that is sort of how they together were clumped in as the NEA4. And their case got all kinds of attention. And Tim subsequently has gone around the country doing autobiographical performance workshops with students at various levels. Mm-hmm. And and also professionals at various levels. I mean, it's just, he's an extraordinary teacher. So I got wind that he was coming, and I had never met him before, but I knew that he was, you know, a gay man, and that his material was personal based. Also, mm-hmm. his is very personal political. Mine is mostly personal with implications of politics. His is like explicitly political a lot of the time. But I knew he was coming, and I knew that I could benefit from learning from him. And there were a couple of spots open, even though I wasn't in the class that he was being hired to come guest for specifically. So I sort of wrote a little essay to get into that class. And I knew intellectually, oh, this might be a nice way to take the personal essay writing from the English department and the playwriting from the theater department and merge them at least for a week and see what that week is going to do. And I remember making a piece in which I criticized the faculty for not knowing what to do with me as a disabled actor and not, you know, casting me in their productions. All but one professor really championed me. And the others, a couple others were fine. And then one was sort of really just never touched me in their productions. And there's a level of like, is it because of my performance or is it because of my disability and you don't know what to do with it? Mm-hmm. And if I was able to know definitively that it was because I wasn't right for a role or because I didn't prepare well enough or because I, you know, isn't what they had envisioned, but is it that I wasn't what they had envisioned because I have a walker, you know, that kind
right,
of.
Right, right.
And we're an undergraduate liberal arts college in the middle of Ohio. Like, frankly, the stakes are not that high. I don't mean to be rude. I just That's mean right. like if you put someone with a walker in a period piece, no one's gonna die. Like no right. one's gonna you're That's not right. you're not gonna be lambasted by critics
I think,
for this
yep.
dissonance kind of thing. So what should have been a space for learning and growth was a space where I felt that I was being excluded. So uh-huh. that was what my piece was for Tim. Being a disabled actor. It was a 3-minute piece filled with criticism, but then filled with hope and promise for the future. And he, at the end of the first night that I performed it, that I basically just improvised it, you know, that's what the workshop is. It's how do you do it? It's devising material and just freeing yourself and not mm-hmm. being prescriptive and not, you know, being committed to words you've put on a page or things like that. I do this little improv and he goes, that was extraordinary. And you know, Ryan, you don't have to wait for those professors. You don't have to wait for people in the business. You don't have to wait for anybody. Your stories are compelling. And you yes. also don't have to hide behind the name of a fictional character or hide behind or try to make your stories less authentic to you so that other people will take them more seriously. You are a legitimate performer, and if you want to be on the stage, you don't have to wait. You can, yes. you can.
I'm nodding my head yes so hard that it's about to crack off my neck and yes. fall onto the ground. Yes.
And yes. So, you know, and that was for a 3-minute bubble of a piece. But then he really pursued me as a student and became a mentor and ended up teaching me 3 more times over the course of my undergraduate career for weeks at a time. So I had 4 weeks of study with him. And then by the second time I took the class, he was like, now it's your turn to teach it. And I was like, you're nuts. Like,
what do you mean
to teach this class? And I certainly didn't teach it until after I graduated college. But then he really was just like, I was like, what am I supposed to teach? He's like, you know how to do this, do this. And can I use your exercises? Sure, you can use my exercises. That's what teaching is. You pass them on from one to the other to the other. And so I think of myself as kind of a little, you know, disciple of his form of study. But over the years, I've found my own, some of my own exercises, certainly some of my own process in terms mm-hmm. of how I make the work when it's me alone by myself. And also, you know, taken from when I do my classes now, I take from several teachers who have taught this kind of work and put the exercises that benefited me most as a student into my own little curriculum that I think is beneficial to the people that I teach.
And this is awesome.
He's so proud and so happy that I took his advice, but I was resistant. You asked if I, you know, wasn't sure. I was resistant because I didn't know that anybody would want to watch me talk about myself even 15 minutes, let alone an hour at a time or 80 minutes at a time. And so that took a lot of insistence and a lot of convincing. And first it was convincing me to make the first play, which was Hi, Are You Single, as my senior capstone or senior thesis. And he said, you have to have a full-length show by the time you graduate college. And I thought he was wild. I thought it was completely wild. But then I came to the realization, I can either do a Tennessee Williams one act that I will never touch again, or I can make my own piece that is going to launch me into a career.
So let's talk more about Hi, Are You Single? For all of our listeners, Hi, Are You Single is currently available to stream. So it's like a co-production between Woolly Mammoth and IAMA. We want you to know, if you're listening to this in 2021, that this streaming version of the show is only available until February 28th. So get on it. You told us a little bit about the original spark for the idea, but tell us more about the show.
Hi, Are You Single is about a person named Ryan, who you could surmise is me, but is a character of myself and a heightened version of myself, but who is gay with cerebral palsy and horny all the time. And it navigates his trials and triumphs in the world of dating and hookups and trying to find love. Mm. And in the process leads to an interrogation of the gay community and mm-hmm. its tendency to marginalize people within its already marginalized self. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Mm-hmm. And then it also turns the table and says, well, you're a gay man. Like, you are just as guilty and just as much a perpetrator of various forms of prejudice and discrimination.
Interesting.
You're not exempt from it. And so,
listen, don't give it all away.
I'm not, but I mean, I think that is in the blurb. So I think it's okay.
Yeah. You're still within the safety of the blurb.
I'm going to tell you, you know, that the show would be very boring if it was just, look at all these men who rejected me, or look at all these men who say things that are not nice, when, like, of course I'm an asshole a lot of the time, some of the time. and I have to have my own reckoning.
And I love that.
In order to make the play a compelling watch.
So many people, though, like will like want to write an autobiographical piece and then not be willing to show that side of themselves that was maybe not at their best or they're not the most proud of. And I think that, like, by revealing that is really, you know, the most compelling part of, like, how, what you learned about yourself in the process.
Yes. I won't disagree. I think you just made a statement. And so I will just say,
don't disagree with it. That's my statement. Cause I didn't put a question mark at the end, But I believe we talked a little bit about this in the intro, but Hi, Are You Single is not the first time you've been inspired to create using your own life experience as a spark. In the cabaret, Falling for Make-Believe, you tell the story of the Haddad Family Theater, which I was captivated by. And I've not seen this show, and I think this might be the one that you said only 100 people saw.
Yeah.
But for the sure. rest of us, can you give us a glimpse into that world? Because it just seemed delightful. I mean, I'm not sure every family member thought so. I can't tell from that description.
I was a little boy and I wanted a stage. And so my grandpa John built me a stage. I'm looking at a picture of him right now on my desk.
Thanks, Grandpa John.
And my grandma Julia, who's sitting next to him in the picture and laughing, sewed the white lace curtains that he put on a rod on a plywood frame that was about 4 feet high. And made a little shadow box kind of puppet show like frame that became our stage. Now I thought that the stage was going to be like the Vivian Beaumont Theater, and so I was very confused. But then I was like, "Well, this is what I got, so I better make it work." And instead of like making little plays by myself or doing little reenactments of Disney movies by myself, I started to recruit my family to do the plays with me. So that was 10 shows in 8 years.
Wow.
That the Haddad family did together from the ages of 5 to 13.
And everyone just did what you said, basically? Like you assigned roles and said, here's what we're going to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the beginning, that is exactly what happened. Like as simple as can be, that is exactly what happened. But I think in the beginning they thought that this was just a fluke and they would have to do it once, like maybe twice. And little did they know they'd have to do it 10 times. And then it would get bigger, bigger and bigger as I got older. Like we moved out of the living room and we moved into the backyard and then we moved to the stage of the community center. And we're now on a stage of the community center. And I'm like an angsty teenager being like, you didn't move the set piece. But there was no.
Oh my God.
I was a mess. But I learned so much. And my family taught me.
You were a tyrant, weren't you?
I was.
Oh my God. I believe it. Fine.
I was. And so the lyric, Dancing in the Backyard, from title of show.
Yes.
And hearing Andrea McCardle sing from a hi-fi in the den. Like that was when I heard that later in my teenage years, after we had concluded our run, like we were already done. And then I play that song and I hear Heidi's voice and I'm just like, and I'm sobbing because it was like, oh my gosh, this is the story of my family. And, you know, not the whole song is not sure. the story of my family, but it felt like at that point it was a premonition of what the trajectory of my life was going to be and is what, you know, fortunately because I'm in the business, is what my life has become. And just the power of even a phrase or a lyric inside of a song to make a child or teenager go, wow, I'm represented here inside of the musical theater canon. You know, it was dancing in the backyard, hearing Andrea McCardle sing, and Somebody Hold Me Too Close, Somebody Hurt Me Too Deep. Those are the two sides of my autobiography of a musical theater kid. So the cabaret, which ends with me singing Away Back to Then, after I've told you all of these stories of all the shows that we did, all the wacky characters conjuring, all the wonderful folks who were in my family or extended family or in our, you know, our family friends or like employees of my father. I was like, this girl.
Oh my God.
This girl seems like she could do it. And then I would be like, Dad, my dad's a dentist. I'd be like, can you ask your dental assistant to sing the star to be in our adaptation of Annie called
Oh
Annie?
My God.
That's amazing. Oh. And your dad did it.
He did. And true? She did it. And she did it.
Like, the what was her name?
The
what was her name?
Was Nicole. Nicole.
Nicole.
Dad was the amazing. Star to be. Was the star to be. I mean.
How'd she do? How did she do? Be
good.
Honest.
She was very good. I think, honestly, the truth was, I realized toward the end, we kind of stopped. We like paused doing musicals for a while and did like 3 straight plays in a row. And then I knew that
just Eugene O'Neill, just long day's journey into night.
No. wasn't that. I'll tell you what it was. We did, these were the final 4 on the stage of the community center. We did like the verbatim text of Lucille Fletcher's Sorry Wrong Number, the radio play that later became a movie with Barbara Stanwyck. So we did the radio play. And then the next
amazing
year, I wrote a sequel called Sorry Wrong Number Act 2. Because I found the play in a book of one-act plays, and I thought it was so clever that it was a one-act play, and I was writing a second act.
Hilarious.
Absolutely wild. And then the third one on the stage of the Community Center, which would have been our 9th and penultimate, was All About Ed, which was an adaptation of All About Eve.
Oh, my fucking God. Oh, my God.
And I played Ed, and it was a disaster. That was the one where I was screaming about scene changes, because nobody told me that when you're adapting a screenplay, or butchering a screenplay, rather, you should minimize the locations if you're putting it on stage. Oh. So I had like 22 different locations in this play.
Oh, my God.
And in my head, I thought, well, the table will go here and the chairs will go here. There wasn't like we had like big flats or anything. But I just knew like what the ground plans were supposed to be. And yet I never wrote them on paper or told a single soul.
Oh, my God.
How were they to know what needed to happen?
I don't know, but you could hear me.
Like tyranny.
The curtain would close in between scenes, and you could hear me screaming at them because they were getting it wrong. They were getting it wrong, but they had no idea what they were supposed to get right.
This must be on videotape. Please tell me.
Thank God it is not.
Oh my God. No. I bet if you calculated the length of the collective scene changes, was that longer than the actual play? Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
Absolutely. And so I tell all these. Oh, and then the final one is an adaptation of Annie called Andy, in which I played Andy. And I wore, I wore a red button down instead of a red dress. And I had a mouthful of braces and orthodontia.
That orphan. Somebody is really financing that orphan's orthodontia. Amazing.
So the cabaret tells the story of this family and the characters and weaves in and out of like other parts of our life that aren't the plays through the songs from the plays that we did or that were associated closely with the plays that we did. And so it's a really beautiful evening, and I haven't, that was one of my last times on a stage before COVID. And I've got to be honest, and I've said this, well, I don't know. I'm never going to say never to doing that show again. I might do it again. I love the songs, and I love, obviously, the family that is characterized in it. But it is, there are certain shows that serve.
Absolutely.
That serve a certain time in your life.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I made this as a gift to, I made it as a gift to my Aunt Joan. And she is kind of the pillar of the show.
Yeah.
And it was made for her and the other members of my family who were, slowly failing health-wise to be able to receive this giant thank you note
yeah
at when they were still able to process important. What I was giving.
Yeah.
And you know, things change. And yeah. I created the show in 2017 and 18. I performed it for the first time in 2019. And then I brought it back for a longer run in 2020. And since then, you know, since 2019, the family and the characters that are talked about have taken, some of them are no longer here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, and Aunt Joan is still here. But others are not. And it is, you know, I would have to, it would take a lot for me to, to do it now.
That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense.
I don't know. That I was heavy. That was heavy.
No.
What I was actually thinking, Ryan, as you were saying that, is I have similar feelings about things that I have made that are, what I would call autobiographical, and once I've sort of expressed the thing and processed through the thing, I often don't want to go back and redo it. Yeah. When we were asked to do the 10-year anniversary, one night only Broadway presentation of title of show, I was like, why are we doing this? If I'm honest, because I was like, it feels like, for me, which is distinct from what you're saying, it just felt like, it was like an article of clothing that once was couture. And I was sort of like, I'm not really that person anymore. So it took, I was like, oh, I'll just act. But it was, and it was for charity. So that felt good. But I get it. There are things that we make that have they have a life. And then mm-hmm. sometimes it's sort of like, I'm done doing that now.
Mm-hmm. Well, 5.5, almost 6 years of Higher Age Single, I'm far from done. And I think that message is.
And that's interesting too.
That message continues. And I continue to feel that I'm still in the place to be able to tell the story, even though I've grown so much and that there's so many other shows I've made and created and that I'm continuing to develop beyond. I'm like, I'm ready for the off-Broadway run. I'm ready for, what is going to come beyond this, one month of digital streaming. But there are others like Falling for Make Believe simply because people died. Like, I'm sorry, but one of the people died last week, I've said this to, my parents' generation in my family, not the older generation who we are slowly starting to lose. But I've said, do you think, can I continue this when they're gone? And they said, well, we think so. Sure, we think so. But it's about, can I sit on the stool and talk about, the two other people who were the two grandfathers who had died prior to the making of the show, that their death is significant to the story. And then there's more, there's more death that I'm not accounting for.
Yeah.
That I'm not accounting for. And I just feel, I know that that's a part of life, but there's that show. And then there's a show called My Straighties, which you described so eloquently in your intro, which was one night for 100 people. And I feel sort of done. I'm happy that I did.
Uh-huh.
I'm happy that it is something I wrote and exists, and maybe I will.
I'm really pleased with the title. I mean, come on.
But even
holds up.
But it doesn't. Okay, it does, but it doesn't. In the sense that, I made a show that was about members of my fraternity and being in a fraternity in college, being the wacky gay boy with a walker in a fraternity in college, in the same fraternity, in the same year and same pledge class, which just means that we entered at the same time, as an active member of the Marines. And and our chemistry was so great. And he was as straight as could be, but also so comfortable with himself that he would carry me all around the house and he would take care of me. And so we were sort of the opposite ends of we represented the total opposite sides of our fraternity. And it was a great experience being in that fraternity. And My Straighties is a show that investigates and explores masculinity and mm-hmm. also what it is to go from having zero straight friends to having a bunch of them, zero straight male friends to having a bunch of them who are really significant and meaningful in your life. But even that, like, sexuality is fluid. And mm-hmm. so the people that I wrote about, while I was developing the show, you know, after college, when the show was being formed, like, I knew that certain individuals no longer identified as straight. And yet I was still writing about them as though they were straight because I was like, it's too complicated to engage with the fact that this person then comes out.
Yeah.
When for my story, like, it's better if they're a straight person.
Right.
That makes sense.
Got it.
And so I'm like, that feels, and I also, like, I loved being in a fraternity, and it added so much to my college experience for a specific period of time. But now I don't, like, wake up in the morning and go, remember when I was in a fraternity, or technically still am because you're sworn in for life or whatever. And it does not cross my mind.
Yeah.
So I just think, like, there's other work to be done, and
absolutely
it represents a certain part of my artistic journey that, like, I don't need to revisit.
Yeah. So if you're not using the title anymore, may I?
You know what?
I don't know what it's going
to
be.
Susan, I'm desperate to see you do a verbatim performance of my script of My Straighties.
I was going to say, it could be that. It could be that. But then just hear me out. It could be my line of hair straightening tools. My Straighties. Just hear me out.
I'm hearing. Susan, can I ask a probing question?
Yes.
I know you're like, this is my podcast. Why are you asking me a question? First of all, the reason you did the 10th anniversary was so that I could see title of show live for the first time and experience the book for the first time. So that it was for me. So that, I want you to know that, forget about charity, that was the only reason you did it, was for Ryan J. Haddad. but also, no, I clocked in the performance that the Susan in the book of title of show, the script of title of show, is married, and is married to someone that the real Susan is no longer married to.
That's exactly the kind of stuff I'm talking about, Ryan, where I was like, it's very, in some ways, there are similarities to what you're talking about, where you're sort of like, how are we accounting for time here? And how are we accounting for change here? And how are we accounting for friends no longer with us here? And, but to your other point, I will tell you, it was a joy to have people like you there to see it for the first time. And people like my now husband, Nathan, didn't even know me then. And I was able to say, not even just tell him, you know, some years ago, I did a thing with my friends, but to show him was really a kick. And so for me, that really was a major justification for doing it, was to be able to say to Ryan, to Nathan, you know, please enjoy. Please enjoy the following.
I have to say, Wes and I got to sit with Nathan as he watched it. So I was getting to, like, relive all the memories and watch it, but then watching it through the eyes of someone who loves Susan Blackwell as much, if not more, than I love Susan Blackwell, and watch him experience it all for the very first time. It was really magical. I'm glad you did it, Suze.
And for Nathan and for Ryan and for all that it ended up being a joyous thing. But but I feel you. It makes so much sense to me, Ryan, especially, and again, Cams does it, I do it, you do it. When you make work out of your life, if you're writing poetry, it can live in its slim little poetry volume, and it can be, you know, you can choose to look at it, you can leave it on the shelf, other people can enjoy it. But when you're the performer of it, and it requires that you get it into your body and do it live, then we get to choose. Mm-hmm. And you know, we get to determine when it feels like it's still, you know, the thing that you're talking about with the show that you're doing now is I feel like you're still living, learning.
Yeah. It's still very alive. Yeah.
It's still, it's alive. That's, I think that's the word. It's alive. Yeah. It's alive.
It feels current.
I want to play a game with you, Ryan, because we're obsessed with our friend Meta Wagner's five creative types. And I don't know how this is going to go. So I'm excited to do this. I'm going to read you five descriptions and you tell us which one most drives your creativity. Okay. Mm-hmm. These are descriptions mm-hmm. of five creative types. Here we go.
Okay.
Number one, you live to make an audience laugh or cry and you love applause and adoration. Number two, you become so immersed in your creative work, you lose all track of time and space. Number three, you thrive on breaking boundaries and crashing conventions. Number four, you need to express yourself and you hope your art will help others. And number five, you have a fiery desire to right wrongs and change the world with your art. Did one of those leap out at you?
Hmm. Oh my God. It's so hard. I want to pick more than one, but you're not going to let me.
Which drives your creativity? Your yeah. creativity.
That's helpful. Thank you. Okay. I think it's four.
You need to express yourself and you hope your art will help others. Ryan,
yes.
Welcome to the club. Laura Camion and I are members of the Sensitive Souls.
Yeah.
You are a sensitive you soul. Yeah. And it's true soul. That you probably have other pieces of all of those things within your being, but creatively, we really relate to this desire to express yourself and order and understand mm-hmm. your lived experience and mm-hmm. the hope that your art is going to help others, that it might make the path easier for others, that it's going to shine a light for others. Welcome to the Sensitive Souls, baby.
Look, I want to be honest and say that like number one was very appealing, but I think number one is incredibly true. But I don't think that it drives the creativity.
Uh-huh.
The creativity is like, why are you making something? Why are you making a particular thing or telling a particular story? Number one is specific to when I'm in performance of the thing.
Uh-huh. Yes. That makes yes.
total sense.
That makes sense.
But it
does. That makes sense. But you could.
Yeah.
Number one is called, just so you know, you live to make an audience laugh or cry and you love applause and adoration. That is an A-lister. And I feel like you could be a sensitive soul with an A-lister rising, right?
Thank you. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
If it were a horoscope. Yes. I love
Thanks
that.
Thanks for playing along. We enjoy that game very much.
Because I think that I think that number one is for interpreters and the others are for people who make work.
That makes so much sense.
So number one is when I'm interpreting what I have already made.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Yes. For people that really thrive downstage, center on zero. In a lavender spotlight, that is when people are interpreting your right, even if it's their own work. This has been good. Very, very good. Thank
Brian,
you,
Brian. Another topic that we're obsessed with here, processing creative failure or perceived failure. Mm-hmm. And we're just wondering if you might have, in your lived experience, something that transpired that you perceived as a failure creatively, and how you processed through it.
In my professional career, not in my before career, because if it was my youth, I would say that, you know, I should never have done All About Ed or something like that. And I learned from the failure of that had a theater production. But as an adult in the entertainment industry, I would say that it is when creative collaborations are no longer working
mm-hmm.
on a specific project and how those things those breakups, those
mm-hmm.
endeavors. And sometimes, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, relationships dissolve yeah. as a result. And I think that, especially as a maker of work, it can take me a while, but sometimes I get to a point where I recognize that it isn't working anymore.
Mm.
And I could have communicated it earlier while I was getting the sense that maybe it wasn't working, to try to resolve any issues or tension or perceived tension. But it's happened twice, and it's not a one-sided thing. So it's not mm-hmm. like I'm blaming this person for doing X, Y, or Z. It's like I acknowledge in myself
yeah.
that that perhaps my conflict resolution skills aren't at the highest level, so that I might have been able to like solve a problem before it exploded. But instead, it's sort of like I come to the conclusion that this isn't working, and I tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurts people's feelings and also creates, you know, anger and resentment. And I am not saying that, like, in all cases, like, I'm the only person to blame. Because I do think it's a two-sided thing. And I think that mm-hmm. sometimes artists, you know, you with the best of intentions, you enter a process and you realize halfway through or three-quarters of the way through that your chemistry is just not vibing. And that is okay. That is similar to romantic relationships. Like, mm-hmm. it is okay yeah. to free yourself. But sometimes in the freeing of yourself, you have to like let go of a person
yeah.
and a relationship that could have been salvaged if communication mm-hmm. was clearer earlier on. And unfortunately then, like, it makes you question whether you also should let go of whatever work it was that they helped you make.
Right, right.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's hard.
Yeah. So is the learning about, it sounds like it's about communication.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's about mm-hmm. just getting better and better. I mean, this is a life's work for anybody, but getting better about timely communication,
yeah,
compassionate saying, communication.
Yes. Just saying, you know, this is what I need. This is what I can give you in return. And continuing to evaluate, do we think this is working? Do we think mm-hmm. this is working? If it isn't working, how do we solve it, or how do we part ways amicably and productively?
Yeah.
To save ourselves from further pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, Ryan, I'm just trying out different approaches. Ryan, you have been in the creativity business for a while now. Give us some good creative advice.
If I'm stuck writing something and I don't want
yeah.
and I don't want to address what I'm obligated to put on the page, either of my own volition or because someone has told me that this is what this scene needs or this is what this play or performance needs, I turn on my voice memos. And I just improvise it.
Ooh.
And I hit record.
Yes.
And this is how I generally develop autobiographical solo work to start with. I begin from an improvised text that then is transcribed and cut apart and reshaped and reformed and edited.
Yeah.
But I have that original as a source to continue mm-hmm. going back to and saying, what was my intention in this moment? Why did I say what I said when I said it? Instead of filtering myself before, instead of filtering myself at the keyboard. So the reason I said, you know, when I'm stuck writing something is because, you know, I haven't written a new solo show now in 2 years. I started with Page Zero and gotten to the end of the first draft. But when I've been in revision of various pieces of work and I haven't been able to sit and just type away, I will hit record and do the same thing that I would normally do at the beginning of the process, but later in the process to say, what does this moment need? And obviously what comes out is total word vomit, but then at least there's some starting point to get your ideas from your brain to the air into a recording and onto the page.
Yep.
Great.
That's great advice.
Great.
Great advice.
Thanks.
You work really, really hard. You do a lot of things. What's it all for?
I think it is for people within the various communities that I represent to see themselves in work where they are often in the background or on the side or not of import or focus to the creators of whatever they are, you know, a part of. I am centering myself, I'm centering gay folks, disabled folks, and Arab, Lebanese, American folks, or just generally Arab folks. And that is powerful.
Yeah.
And so it is about representation, but it's also about what representation can do to other people outside of those communities, and particularly with disability, the ways in which assumptions are made about disabled people living in this world, the ways in which the world is not built for disabled people to exist to their fullest potential, and trying to dismantle that by telling stories that will change the way, I won't say disability is seen. I used to say that in high school, but like, I can't believe I used to say that in high school. And now 10 years after graduating high school, this year will be 10 years. I'm still saying a version of that same sentence. It really just means like when you encounter a disabled person, don't presume to know what their story is, what is going on in their lives or their body or their mind or their heart, just because of the way society has conditioned you to only see us as vessels for inspiration, for your non-disabled inspiration. That is not what we are for. We are humans with full, rich, compelling, complex lives. And sometimes there are people who are disabled who don't see themselves that way because of the narrative that society tells them, and by and by extension, the narrative that the media tells them about themselves. They don't have the empowerment because they believe the fallacies that are being told about disability all the time. So by telling very relatable, accessible stories which feature disabled characters and situations, most of the time so far where the characters are myself, but going further, going expanding and opening up, which I am doing, seeing that like, oh my, you know, Ryan's horny all the time in How Are You Single? I'm horny all the time sitting in this chair. Doing this podcast.
Like right now.
Right.
Yes.
But just like letting people know. Letting people know that people are, you know, that we are sexually viable beings and you could and should, with consent, have sex with us. Like, Exhibit B, disabled people are not angelic beings that are only vehicles for positivity or or fairy, magical fairies of happiness. No.
Yeah.
We can be total assholes, as you'll see if you watch How Are You Single. I become an asshole, and that is the point of the show. And disabled people can also be assholes. Like, yeah. It's like that we're just people, and there are good and there are bad. There are good and there are bad among us and among our within ourselves. See, I'm thinking of all the different pieces and what it represents. I have a gay family play called Good Time Charlie, and it's like, well, a disabled person can exist in a supporting role on stage, but inside of a Lebanese American family in which the disability is not the story, is not at any moment the story at all, period. It's not. And it doesn't mean that play does not also provide disabled representation. I am still on the stage in a walker with six other actors playing my family. But the point is, it is a family story, and the disabled people can exist inside of families where, guess what? Disability is not the conflict. It's not.
Yep.
And letter D, the last one, I'm thinking now of Dark Disabled Stories, which, again, title subject to change. That's a show that I've struggled with. What is the point? What am I doing? What am I representing here? And I say a line that contradicts what I just said 3 minutes ago on this podcast, which is, why should we, not everything is accessible to us, so why should we try to make all our stories accessible to you? And it's a very different tone of my other work and my other things. And the point of that is, we not only struggle to be not inspiring, like I'm not inspiring going to the grocery store. Like, I shouldn't be inspiring going to the grocery store. I just
trying to
want
get my groceries.
but the other thing that we fight against, the other sort of stigma, is that we are victims. Of people and society and poor us. Isn't it sad? Don't we have the worst and the saddest lives? I am never trying to show that disabled people are victims, because we are not. We are not. If there's a problem, it's the problem with the rest of you. It is not a problem with us. And so Dark Disabled Stories is a show in which it is dark. It is not the slap happy comedy that I usually do, or comedy that veers into some serious stuff and some poignant stuff. This show is just like, this is a drama. We were doing a reading of it this week, and when we did our first read at the top of the week after some time away, I was like, oh, this isn't funny. this is a drama now. And the thing, like, I'm so afraid of showing us as victims, and I'm fighting against it, and I don't want to. And yet, this is a show in which I say not everything needs to be accessible to you if not everything is accessible to us. And I'm going to show you some ugly stuff. I'm going to tell you some really ugly stuff. And when I tell you that, it doesn't mean that we are victims. It still doesn't mean that we are victims. You should be able, as non-disabled people, to sit and process and intellectualize the fact that bad things can happen to people, and those people are still not victims. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I just named a bunch of stuff, and this has now been longer than the entire podcast. And I don't even remember the question.
Though. The question
said,
is, what's
is
it all for?
What is it all for? And so what it's for is a reframing and a acknowledgement of humanity and autonomy that is deprived of us so often as disabled people. And you could say the same for gay people, and you could say the same for Middle Eastern people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan, what or who is sparking you these days?
A comedian and actress named Nicole Byer. From Nailed It and Girl Code and various other programs. I listened to the first episode of her podcast not knowing like what was being turned on, but the company manager of Woolly Mammoth, who picked me up in Ohio and drove me to DC so I didn't have to get on the plane in the middle of COVID to do my show. And I just want to go back for 5 seconds. And you were like, what is a creative risk you've taken lately? And I, the actual, like, leaving my parents' house to go to Washington and film where there would be people in the audience, even masked and COVID tested. That was a risk. And I was very scared.
Part
of that risk, part of mitigating that risk was setting a boundary and saying, I don't want to be on a plane. And I was in Ohio, and DC is, what, 6 hours away. So the gorgeous company manager, Eleonora Sapp, got in a rental car and drove to Ohio and picked me up. And so I could feel safe even from the beginning of that process. And in the car, she turned on Nicole's podcast, Why Won't You Date Me? I don't know. It's, again, Why Won't You Date Me? My show is called Hi, Are You Single? Do you see a threat? And so I really, my ears perked up, and I don't know how Eleonora did that. She like started at the beginning. She started at episode one back in like 2017.
Road trip, yes.
And I have been devouring that podcast since November because of how resonant it has been. So I will tell you that for the last, especially the last month, 2 months out of three, I've been eating my meals with Nicole Byer.
And that's a great spark.
And listening to the, and listening to the podcast, and not only learning how it, what it is to just be funny off the cuff all the fucking time and makes me cackle out loud in the middle of a pork chop or something. also really like she's digging into the issues of her single life, being a woman in her 30s who is a black woman in her 30s who is has never had a boyfriend. And I'm walking through the world as a disabled man at 29 going, why has this not happened for me? And so the introspection that she is doing with her guests and the generosity of her guests to go with her on that journey through every episode is really soulful. So it's hitting me as both an artist and a human, and I'm really grateful. And I hope that Nicole, I don't know if she listens to the Spark File podcast, but I would like to be her friend and I would like to work with her. And also just like say thank you for making it so that I don't have to eat alone.
Put it out in the universe. Manifest Nicole Byer at your actual article dining room nook table.
That's right.
The article dining chairs with a dining table from elsewhere that already has
the scratch.
Wayfair. Pardon me.
Thank you so much to our most fabulous guest, Ryan Haddad.
So that's it. This episode of The Spark File was made on Muncie, Lenape, and Seminole land. We hope it put another bunch of sparks in your file. If there's a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and you fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that with us so that we can share it with the world, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We will even happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you have to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. It really does help people find the podcast. And if you like it, share it with people that you love. And if you didn't like it, I don't know, Ryan, what do you say to your critics?
I lightly read one pass of each review and then I fold the paper and never open the link again.
Okay. But
the
yes.
But yes. The quotes, some quotes do stick with me in their negative. But I just try to say, you know, that is what that person said. Thank you.
There you go.
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You got to take it
and make it.
Make it.
Bye.
Ryan.
Ryan, Laura.
Thank you.
A light reading, one pass light reading. I fold the paper. And I never look at it again.
That is it.
I love that.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark files. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark files. I jump into my spark files. Let's open up the spark files.